It is. It's, you know, I wouldn't trade it for anything, I don't think. And it's interesting because for a long time, and I talk about this, you know, change that happened with me, which we can get into, but it was about 2 years ago that I really began to start to cultivate more daily joy and kind of climb out of that dark space that, you know, because I mean, if you live in that and you live in the darkness and you photograph it and you witness it, that can become your world very easily. And it became mine. And for the longest time, I felt shrouded in darkness, you know.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you are hearing this, you have once again tuned the Consequence of Habit podcast. And this is your host, JT. You know, on this podcast, we have in-depth conversations with our guests about the impact that habits have played on their life, both good and bad. And we use these conversations to help us better understand the things that are in our control and the things that aren't. It helps us analyze the things we do on a daily basis and have an honest conversation about whether those things are adding value to our life or they're holding us back. So with that said, let's get it started. All right, this week on the podcast, I had the privilege of sitting down with Erin Grace Treve. Erin's a photojournalist and a filmmaker, and she's covered every major conflict or social impact event since 2007. You can find work in publications like the New York Times and National Geographic, as well as many, many more. You know, I initially scheduled this interview. My thought was it was really going to be about just the work. But I was extremely grateful to the fact that Erin opened up. She got super vulnerable and told us about her own stories of dealing with stress and trauma and the habits that she now uses to kind of mitigate those stressors. A lot of things are changing around here, a consequence of habit. A lot of updates, a lot of things moving around, but one thing remains the same. And that is my unwavering support and love for Athletic Brewing Company. These guys have been part of my journey from the very beginning. And I was even curious about what not drinking beer, well, not drinking leaded beer would look like and how it could possibly make this happen. But these guys provide a product that makes that transition fairly simple. So maybe you just want to either cut down on some of your drinking, you just want to replace it with something that doesn't have alcohol, or like me, alcohol does not fit into your life. Either or, these guys got something for you. The one prerequisite, you have to like good beer. If you like crappy beer, look elsewhere. If you guys have not tried Athletic Brewing Company and you want to give it a shot, use promo code capital COH20. Get you 20% off your first order. So huge thanks to Erin. Without further ado, please welcome to the podcast, Erin Treve. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Consequence of Habit podcast. This is your host, JT. And today, man, this is a big one. I'm joined by Erin Treve. Erin was introduced to me by Connor Cook. So Connor, huge shout out to you. I really appreciate that. And Erin, first off, thank you for joining us. You know,
thanks for having me.
Yeah. So when I hit you up, about coming on, you said something that I'm very sympathetic to. You said, hey, my sleep is not great. So let's wait a day or two until, you know, I get a good night's rest to come on. And I feel, as someone who travels quite a bit, this kind of perpetual jet lag / insomnia fog. So, I was telling somebody before I came on that I was sitting down with you for a conversation. I said, you know, we're going to do the other day. She wasn't sleeping great. I said, I have COVID brain. So between the two of us, there might be a whole lot of open air time of us just kind of trying to figure out, trying to piece words together. So
sadly, I my lack of sleep, I don't know if it came from traveling, but I literally switched time zones by an hour. And somehow, I don't know if that was it, but I definitely... Yeah, I've had some brain fog this summer.
Yeah. Well, so the whole point of this podcast is to bring awareness to the impact that habits have on our mental health, our success, and the environment. Let's just kick it off with that, with just sleep, just because when you're a photojournalist, you know, I've heard in other interviews, you know, you've talked about being like a conflict journalist, but that maybe that's not a term that you always like. You're more like a social justice photographer. Am I saying that correct?
Correct, yes.
Okay. But with that work, you literally have traveled all over the world. What is your sleep schedule look like, and what are some of the habits that maybe you've adapted over time to try and be able to fall asleep? Because it's not just time zones. We're going to get into it, but there's going to be a whole lot of adrenaline going through your systems at times too. Has sleep been this kind of elusive thing in your past 12 years of work?
It has. And, you know, I didn't quite put the amount of importance on it until really the past 2 years, which the past 2 years, I would say right when COVID started, I had basically an awakening that changed my life. And it wasn't necessarily because of COVID, but it just all kind of fell into place. And that's when sleep became one of my lifelines. Basically, I realized that, you know, not having enough, I mean, you know, depriving people of sleep is a form of torture. Sure. And I don't think that we give enough credit to how much sleep affects just our daily ability to function well as human beings. And I would say before, it was just kind of, I had the mentality of like, you'll sleep when you're dead.
Yeah.
I heard that a lot, you know, during embeds with the military. And now it's one of my key touchstones of just well-being and mental health. Like I put sleep as a number one priority. I would say that's had a huge impact on my health, positively, is just prioritizing sleep.
Yeah. Now you've been embedded with the military multiple times, right? So have you seen even within the military, like I remember, you know, when after 9/11, when things first kicked off, like the amount of guys just literally running on like energy drinks, ephedrine, you know, whatever kind of stimulant they could get in their system. But as we all know that there's a shelf life to that, right? Like that is, for a lot of different reasons, not ideal for thought process, decision-making, things like that. Have you seen that within the military change at all, whether the times you're in bed with them, or are we just talking about there's just so much conflict going on in those times that, like, you know, are guys hyped up amped up on caffeine and stimulants, or are they starting to understand that the importance of trying to get some shut eye?
Yeah. I mean, it's been a while since I've embedded with the US military. My first, I would say, real experience photographing conflict was in 2009 when I embedded with the US Army for 3 months in Afghanistan during what at that time was called the surge. Obama was sending hundreds of thousands of troops into Afghanistan. And I thought it was, you know, my opportunity to see a full all-out war led by, you know, one of the most powerful militaries in the world. And definitely there was a lack of sleep. In fact, the military taught me how to sleep in almost any given situation. You could just catch 15, 30 minutes of sleep wherever you were. And I slept with my, you know, Kevlar vest on, I slept with my helmet on. I can now fall asleep pretty easily in any situation because you know, basically your body's trained to do that. So that kind of was a gift in a sense.
Yeah.
Definitely we lived off of these drinks called Rippets, which were I think they were given to the military for free. Rippet was a sponsor, but it was this really disgusting, but also kind of like, you know, delicious and addictive energy drink that we would all chug before going out on missions. And because sometimes the missions would start at 3 a.m. and you'd go to bed at midnight, right? So it was definitely not, you know, opportunities to learn great habits during that time.
No. Now, I want to get back to kind of the beginning, and I don't want to dwell on it too much just because if it, you know, there's other, you've been in other interviews and you kind of talk about your childhood and going to Texas A&M and, but you, something that struck me when I heard you in other interviews is you were drawn to photography specifically around things like World War II, right? Like, there was something about capturing those moments of just raw life, death, kind of, you know, on the verge of seeing the, you know, being involved in some of the most traumatic things a human can be involved in. What do you think it is about those images that kind of stood out to you that really kind of drew you in and led you down that direction?
Yeah, you know, I've always been drawn to human suffering in some shape or form since I was a child, really. You know, I used to go out and, well, I was very religious as a small child. My family wasn't so religious. We went to church, which is a, you know, traditional thing that you do in Texas, socially and just, yeah, in the Bible Belt. But then I, you know, I've always kind of taken things to a level of 1,000%. I became a very devout Catholic, was, you know, wanted to be a missionary. I wanted to be a nun. I started feeding the homeless in high school, by myself. I'd go out and, you know, under highway bridges and distribute food, which, you know, as a 16-year-old female, it wasn't the safest activity, but, you know, I was just always drawn to people who had stories to tell that could further my empathy personally, and then the understanding of others. And I just, you know, I've always had a heart for that type of work. And so it's, you know, I think it's been in my psyche since I was young to just, you know, go out and find those people and do that type of work. And then when I discovered that photography was a passion of mine in high school, you know, it just was a natural, sort of, I guess you could say a convergence of two things together. You know, can I combine photography with addressing social needs and human suffering and, you know, issues that people are dealing with and highlight those issues through photographic images. Mm. So that's what, you know, when I was 19 years old, I knew that I wanted to be a social, you know, what I call social documentary photographer, but also photojournalist, and to really experience that type of, you know, human shared experience with other people.
Yeah. You know, when I first came across your name, I spent some time just going through your photos. I thought it'd be an interesting, almost experiment, because anytime I've done research on somebody, it's always written, right? It's usually written. It's something I can read about on my, and I said, I'm not going to read anything. I'm just going to go through these photos. I started on your Instagram and I just went from photo to photo, just looked at them. And there's this dichotomy of war. You have these photos that both American soldiers, we're going to get into Ukraine. You just got back from Ukraine and some of the devastation you've seen. So there's this ominous feeling of some of, I mean, there's, you know, of death, and other ones of complete joy of someone accomplishing something. And it's this spectrum that you're capturing on both sides. And I was curious on what it must feel like, because out of all those photos, I would imagine there's a million other photos that didn't make it right to this spot, to be the one that was used, and what that's got to feel like to be behind the lens of seeing these extremes for 12 years now, and what that must kind of play on your psyche, to live on the fringes of this spectrum of death and triumph. You know, it's like, it's gotta be a strange place.
It is. It's, you know, I wouldn't trade it for anything, I don't think. it's interesting because for a long time, and I talk about this, you know, change that happened with me, which we can get into, but it was about 2 years ago that I really began to start to cultivate more daily joy and kind of climb out of that dark space that, you know, because I mean, if you live in that and you live in the darkness and you photograph it and you witness it, that can become your world very easily. And it became mine. And for the longest time, I felt shrouded in darkness. You know, I used to describe it like I was living behind a black veil. And, you know, there's been bouts of extreme depression combined with anxiety.
Sure.
That was my life for a very long time. Yeah. And, you know, there are, you know, getting back to the consequence of habit, there are habits that I've implemented in my life that have completely turned my life upside down in the best way possible. And, you know, I finally feel like I was able to crawl out of that darkness and back into the light, which is kind of my natural state. You know, I was a happy-go-lucky, carefree, joyous kid growing up and even throughout my 20s. And it wasn't until I experienced war and death and violence that my whole demeanor, I wouldn't say my demeanor actually changed. I was still on the surface a pretty, you know, seemingly happy and chill person. But inside I was definitely suffering. So yeah, it's a journey, you know. I hate to use a trope, but it is a journey. One with, you know, life lessons that don't stop, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, and you know, it's kind of, you learn to how to live in it. It's a weird lifestyle. Like, my life is definitely weird, I think, to outsiders who look at what I do and, you know, see kind of my trajectory. But it's one that I have learned to love.
And I've heard you say that. I mean, I heard you say in an interview, and I didn't find this morbid at all. You said, if I were to go tomorrow, I would have known that I've lived a very rich, full life. And I thought, what an amazing thing for anyone to be able to say, right? Like, that is, you know, 'cause it's coming for us all at some point. So if you can sit back and say that today, well, you're in a better place than a lot of people. So that's an amazing thing to hear somebody say.
JT, I'm so lucky. Like, I, you know, just given the amount of, I would say, like, extreme bouts of depression that I've experienced and anxiety, and to have overcome those, I feel often like the luckiest person on earth. Like, yeah, every day I find joy. Every day I find light and happiness. And, you know, even yesterday, like, one of the habits I've really come to love is trail running. And yesterday I was trail running in Montana, where I just moved to. And there was a storm on the horizon and I could see these huge lightning bolts coming. And, you know, I was running down and just thinking, like, you know, this is something I never would have experienced a few years ago.
Yeah.
And just, you know, just getting to live a full, rich life is such a gift.
So I got a couple questions. Do you think you actually live a richer life now because you've experienced and seen the things that you've seen? You know, almost like somebody says, hey, I almost died on of cancer, or name whatever it is. And they go, I look at life in a different way now than I possibly could have ever looked at it before. Or do you think you're kind of back to like that homeostasis of where you were prior?
No, I think my life is far richer and more full because of my experiences. You know, some of the most grateful people on this planet are recovering alcoholics or recovering addicts. And I spend a lot of time with people who are in recovery, and they look at life like every moment is a gift. And it doesn't mean that it's easier. You know, we're still thrown a lot of curveballs. I myself am not sober, but I would consider myself to be someone who's in recovery. Mm-hmm. Because you've been to the edge of, you know, I would say the edge of, you know, some of life's scariest moments, and then you've come back from that, it kind of creates a whole new level of living that otherwise you wouldn't be able to experience had you not had those very high highs and low lows, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You know, there's something I feel like I should say, and just to make sure it's covered, but there isn't really a conflict, a major conflict, or event that you really haven't covered when we're talking about, like, you know, the big ones. So it's expected, right? Like, that's the thing that I think has changed over the years, is it's expected that if someone is subjected, views, involved in this type of trauma, which is not normal for the human brain to be able to process, right? That there are going to be ramifications, and all of those are, although they may not feel like it, they are a normal reaction to what you're seeing, right? It's not mm-hmm. normal to see these things. Did you realize in real time that I'm slipping behind this veil of darkness, or was there like an aha moment?
I did not realize at the time.
Yeah.
No. It took months, I would say, of compounding events.
Yeah.
For me to kind of, you know, look around me and be like, oh my God, this is kind of a fucked up situation. Yeah, sure. You know, and I would say it started with when I was first, you know, embedding with the US military. Those were the high highs. I loved it. I don't want to say I loved conflict, but I loved being with, you know, the platoon, sort of that familial structure.
Yeah.
I loved being attached to a group of people and getting to photograph their daily interactions. I mean, as a photographer and a photojournalist, our sort of dream or our best suited situation is to be a fly on the wall. And that's what I was when I was embedded. And so photographically speaking, and, you know, to make my work and make pictures, it was kind of a dream situation. Granted, there was obviously a lot of violence, a lot of death, a lot of injury, and that was always hard to see. But somehow, you know, and every vet I know who served during that time will say it was some of the worst, you know, experiences, but at the same time, they would go back in a heartbeat without question. Right. So that's something that's, you know, to me, that's still really enigmatic. Like, why do we crave, you know, these situations that we find ourselves in that are so horrible, but also deeply impactful? And I think it's because you feel the most alive, you know, when you're at war. And most, you know, veterans and military will tell you that every other thing kind of sloughs off, and the thing that you focus on, you know, it's very primitive. It kind of brings us back to our evolutionary roots, where you are focused on surviving, sleeping, eating, not dying, not getting shot, not getting blown up, right? And that's it. And then you're sort of platoon family unit, right? In which case you develop this laser focus, and that's how we evolved as animals, yeah, was to hunt, gather, you know, survive. So I think that there's something to be said about that. So that was, you know, part one. Part two was when I came back and began photographing that same unit at Fort Drum in upstate New York. And I was really curious, okay, this is, you know, it was the third, battalion. Oh God, I can't remember military acronyms at this point, the 3rd Brigade Combat Team, okay, which was made up of, I want to say 4 to 5 different battalions. And I embedded with almost all of them. So when I came back and I went up to Fort Drum, I knew this huge, you know, military unit, and everyone knew who I was. And so I had a lot of access to these men and women as they were redeploying back to the States. And I spent about 6 months living in Fort Drum, or living in Watertown, New York, which is the town adjacent to Fort Drum. I was, you know, spending 5 days a week in the barracks with these 19-year-old kids who I had been with at war and now wanted to see what their homecoming journey was like. And it was horrific. Yeah. It was awful. That was something I was definitely not prepared for, was the amount of suffering I would see and witness stateside compared to that of being embedded in Afghanistan. So yeah, I would say that that's where like a lot of the trauma definitely began. This particular unit had an unprecedented amount of suicides, homicides, family violence. I mean, it was almost like every 2 weeks we'd find out that another soldier had killed himself. And I say himself because I was dealing mostly with infantry, which at that time was not allowing females. Yeah. So it was all boys, really, 19 to, you know, 25-year-old, what I consider kids at this point. I just turned 40 this summer, so to me, they're kids. It was so startling and so upsetting to watch, how much they were suffering, and also how much the military at that time didn't really facilitate the needs of these service members in terms of their trauma and PTSD. At that time, PTSD was still kind of like a dirty word, right? Taboo, like nobody wanted. Yeah, nobody wanted to talk about it. You know, I didn't even tell people when I was at Fort Drum what I was doing, you know, like, because I knew if I had mentioned I was making a story about PTSD, which, you know, it didn't start off at that. It kind of evolved to become about trauma. What I really wanted to see was what was, you know, these soldiers' lives like at home. And then it evolved into a story about PTSD. But yeah, I didn't tell people at Fort Drum I was doing that, because if I did, I wouldn't have gotten the access I had. I didn't lie about what I was doing. I said I was there to document what their lives were like after they'd come back from war. But, you know, very quickly it developed into a story about trauma and suicide. And watching the amount of, sorry, I know I'm you know, talking a lot, but this is a really important topic to me. Watching the amount of overly prescribed medications, the lack of holistic treatment, the lack of professional help, and then people overseeing how the medications were affecting these service members was horrifying. And you know, that was a firsthand education about how trauma and pathologies and different, you know, mental illnesses are treated in our country. I think over the past 10 years since 2009, we've evolved a lot, and you know, I think mental health is now treated a lot differently. But at that time, it was still, highly stigmatized, and people weren't talking about PTSD. Now PTSD, I feel like everybody, you know, is using it sometimes in incorrectly, sure. You know,
sure. But so I think one of the, and I don't even know if the word advantage is the right word, but to, you know, we talk about like empathy for someone to have been embedded with them, right? First, and then you're there, you're doing a job, right? You're taking pictures the entire time and you're capturing these moments. And you correct me if I'm wrong, but in my mind, it's almost, you're there for a job, just like a soldier's there for a job. And you're going to have the same, you know, sympathetic nervous system, this whole fight or flight during the time that you're in theater. And now you're documenting them for this homecoming project. And you're seeing some of the struggles where there are some emotions and feelings that you were going through the same time where you can go, obviously you're not involved in any physical altercations, but you go, okay, well, I kind of get it. I get it a little bit because since then I'm having certain feelings or were you not aware in that moment, that maybe this is something that could be affecting me as well.
I wasn't aware until years later.
Is it crazy?
It's weird that you can experience a trauma and not even know that it was a trauma. And for me, the symptoms popped up, I would say, 3 to 5 years later. I'll be honest, there were physical, I wouldn't say altercations, but I was sexually assaulted by one of the soldiers I was photographing. And it took me a long time to, number one, realize that I was even assaulted. I didn't even know. I didn't really understand that it was assault, which, you know, thank God for the Me Too movement, because now women, I feel like, and men, but especially women are starting to understand, oh, geez, like that I was sexually harassed or this is inappropriate. Whereas before we were just told, that was, you know, that was kind of the way it goes, or, you know, a lot of times in photojournalism back in 10, 15 years ago, it was like, well, this is a boys club, you know, it's to be expected. And now that conversation and narrative is really changing.
Yeah.
Thank God, because it's about time.
Sure.
For that to happen. But, after the assault, I told the lieutenant of the platoon who I was friends with at the time. I didn't know what to expect. I told him, and he said to me, he was a good guy, but I think this is, again, the narrative at the time. He said, well, if you're hanging out with an all male platoon, what do you expect? Like, you know, you're the only female there, blah, blah, blah. And I knew if I addressed it with the up the chain of command, I would have gotten kicked off the base and I wouldn't have been able to continue my work. So I didn't tell anyone. And it wasn't until years later when I found myself really depressed. I was having a hard time getting out of bed, finding any meaning to life on a day-to-day basis. I was seeing actually a psychiatrist at the VA who was treating me sort of on the side, mm-hmm. because she liked me and, you know, was empathetic towards, you know, my situation. At the time, it was really hard to find good therapists to address trauma specifically. I feel like now all therapists are at least getting some sort of trauma training, which is amazing. Right. But yeah, at that time, 10 years ago, I couldn't really find anyone. She said, look, I'll treat you for free on the side. She's an amazing doctor, but she, we were talking and, I just said, I don't understand why I feel this way, why I'm so depressed. And she said, okay, let's go over all the traumatic events that happened to you while you were embedded. You know, there was this bombing, there was, you know, this firefight that time you were in the, MRAP that hit an IED. And so we kind of went through it. Right. And then I said, oh, and there was this time that, you know, I was almost raped by a soldier I was photographing. And she was like, hold the phone. Okay, that's a big issue. And it had never occurred to me to even bring it up. I just thought, oh, well, it happened, you know, and it's over. And I wasn't actually raped, so it shouldn't be that big of a deal. And it took me a while to realize it was a big deal. And it affected you know, every part of my lizard brain, including, you know, that basically created a situation where, yeah, I was depressed. And, but it was weird how I couldn't piece that together by myself. I don't think we're taught necessarily, but it's like people ask why women don't report things right when they happen. And there's some sort of visceral reaction where we feel like we can't talk about it, where we can't tell anyone, or we have to keep it a secret, or we don't think it's an issue that we should bring up because it's not that big of a deal.
Anyway, what's crazy is the way that people justify these things, because if a friend told you that happened to me, it would seem like a big deal. I imagine you could look at that.
Right, exactly.
You know what I mean? But we to ourselves, we can compartmentalize these things. And then we go, I can't understand why I do X, Y, Z. And it's this whole thing of like connecting our actions with these emotions that we may not even know we have. And as humans, that's what's so frustrating to me. Like, I literally was just saying this to my wife. I'm like, God, I just wish you could, if you did something, you could instantly go, oh, wait, maybe it's got something to do with this.
And, right.
But the thing is, when you do that, you have empathy for everybody else. You start to realize like the reason somebody, you know, like one of the most unfortunate things is like you said, hey, the VA, they were treating things in a certain way. They're doing better now. Yeah. But the price of admission has been a lot, right? Because yeah. A lot of people, they come home and you think soldiers are disciplined and you know, they're going to act a certain way with honor. And then, you know, we forget that these people have seen the worst of fucking humanity. And then you expect them to act a certain way when they get home. Like, that's just not, we're not robots. That's not the way we work. And I imagine that if you're photographing, that's just not the way these things work, right? Like, we have to work through some of these things. You mentioned you picked up a couple of habits that have been beneficial for you. You mentioned trail running. What are some of the other things that you've really kind of stood out to you as adding value to your life?
Yeah, and I want to touch on, before we move on to the habits, I want to touch on what you just said about coming back from war and being expected to act a certain way. I'm reading a book right now called The Body Keeps the Score. Yeah. And I've owned this book for probably 5 years, but I've never picked it up because I've been a little afraid to read it. It's definitely heavy, and I've lived with trauma now for 10 years. So it's like, do I really want to, you know, read about trauma at the end of the day when really I kind of want to watch Netflix. I am, you know, reading it, and there is scientific proof now that the brain chemistry actually changes and the structure of the brain changes and the body chemistry changes after either experiencing trauma firsthand or witnessing trauma. And that's something that I think people don't understand. And, you know, it is being destigmatized now a little bit more, where as before, I think people were like, oh, if you have, you know, trauma or PTSD, then you're weak or something's wrong with you, or you just can't handle the stress and the pressure. And that conversation is changing now with the amount of scientific research that's being placed upon trauma. You know, thank goodness people are realizing it's not about, you know, will or character.
Right. Yeah. It's not a lack of moral character or
it's,
yeah.
No, it's definitely not, like, you know, I think that's the scary part, is when, you know, someone who has, I have a, you know, a fairly, how should we put it? I've always been in touch with my feelings. I've been in therapy since I was 20. So I had a pretty good grasp on, you know, things like cognitive behavioral therapy before I even went into traumatic situations. And yet here I was coming out of those, still not being able to put that puzzle piece together. And the way, and like you, and that to me is a total mystery. Like, why can't we say, oh, this happened to me, and then that's why you know, it equals this. It's almost like there's some sort of, I don't know how to describe it. It's like we can't, everything becomes like a fog. I like to describe it like putting a puzzle together that's all white with no edges.
Yeah, I like that.
And And it's so fucking hard to do, to figure out. And it took me a decade, right? And I was someone who was already in touch with a lot of those topics, a lot of the, you know, just basically therapy in general. So then you take some 19-year-old kid from Oklahoma who doesn't have any sort of basis for mindfulness or CBT, or who doesn't even understand his or her own feelings, and you throw them into a situation like that, it is hell when they come back. It's absolutely, you know, just the hardest thing for a human to deal with. So, yeah.
As all of you know, nothing in this world is free. You're going to have the best of intentions. You want to do good in the world. Well, guess what? Unfortunately, at the end of the day, it costs money. You need to find people, organizations, groups that believe in your mission and support it. I was fortunate enough to come across the Patriot Fund. I reached out to these guys and I told them what I'm looking to do within the veteran community. And they were so quick in response and really got behind what we're doing and have been a huge part of making the workshops that we hold for veterans a possibility. Now, in fact, we have one coming up October 1st. It's for active duty, reserve, guard, veteran. If you're in that military community, this is for you. And it probably would not have happened without the support of the Patriot Fund. So check these guys out at thepatriotfund.org. My own personal experience has been like, if you really want, because we all talk about destigmatizing, right? But I think the true destigmatizing comes when not just the acceptance of others that are suffering is when you can realize it's your own self that's suffering. I don't know if that makes sense, but when you can accept that, like you say, hey, this happened to me. I already knew these things and I wasn't making that connection. And I think the real, you really destigmatize something when you go, wait a minute. Why would I think that it wouldn't happen to me? Why am I different than everybody else? See, that's what, like the way our brains work. There is a response to what we see and experience. And as soon as we figure that out, then you're like, oh, now it's destigmatized because it's me too.
Right. And it takes sometimes years to realize that you are not outside of it.
Sure.
And that's the thing is like, you know, with my camera, photojournalists and myself included, we always say that it's like when you have the camera up to your eye and you're photographing, it's almost like you're watching a film through the viewfinder.
Yeah.
And you can somehow, you feel physically and mentally outside of the situation that you're witnessing. And in a way, the camera physically is a protective barrier, right? Like when I remember being like photographing an IED that had gone off and had blown this MRAP off the road. And the soldier who was in the turret was, you know, wounded severely. His intestines were hanging out. It was awful. And as soon as I took my camera down, I was like, oh shit, 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 shit. I'm here. I'm like in this situation. And so I put the camera back up and I immediately felt some weird relief. Like I was somehow creating a barrier between myself and the situation I was actually in. And so, you know, it was almost like a mind trick, a mind game that I would play with myself. And it really, you know, it was kind of like a leaky roof. Like there were a few drops here and there. And then the more it leaked, the more the roof started caving in. And I would say it really took place that spring when I was living up at Fort Drum. I was taking, I remember this one kid, I took him to a mental health hospital or psychiatric ward. It was Valentine's Day, 2010. And he had called me because he was trying to kill himself. And I drove from New York City 6 hours through a snowstorm up to Fort Drum to, you know, come get him. And when I'd walked in the room, there was a blood trail, of just from him had, you know, he had been cutting himself. And I remember cleaning up this blood and taking him, you know, we sat together for 12 hours and I had to convince him to let me take him to the psychiatric ward. And I took him and I sat with him in the hospital and, And they took him away. You know, it's weird that they let me in with my camera, and I was photographing the whole thing also, which was also strange. And I don't know if they didn't notice or what, but I took him as a friend, but I also was there to do my job too. And so I was photographing the entire situation. And I remember they took him away and closed the doors that, you know, they locked. And then I didn't have access to him. And it felt like my insides had been ripped out. Like I was absolutely inconsolable. And I went into the hospital chapel and I just bawled my eyes out.
Was it just a release? Was it a release of all of this? What was it about that really affected you so much?
You know, and Adam was just one of, you know, 10 guys that I was close to that was, were dealing with similar problems. There was another kid, Dirk Terpstra, who committed suicide. I drove to Michigan to visit his family. I went to his funeral. There was another soldier who had slit the throat of another soldier that was on desk duty in the barracks. I was corresponding with the one soldier that was in prison who didn't even remember doing it because he was so hopped up on medications that the mental health department at Fort Drum had basically medicated him to the point of where he was like a catatonic zombie and didn't remember committing the act. So it was one thing after another, after another. I lived, you know, with the same soldier, Adam, who was violent and was having, hallucinations. And at one point I thought he might, you know, hurt me or, you know, do something to me. But it didn't even occur to me that like, what I was doing, this sounds insane, but it didn't occur to me that what I was doing was affecting my own mental health. Isn't that crazy?
So from, like, you know this, but from an outsider listening to that, it's insane. It's insane.
Right? Like I remember calling, I was living with this or not living with him. I was in this guy's living room and I called a mentor of mine and I said, you know, I think Adam is, you know, he's having some violent tendencies and I'm kind of afraid that like he might do something to me while I'm asleep on his couch. And my friend was like, get the fuck out of there. Like, what are you? Yeah. But it's like, and I, you know, but everyone I talk to who does this type of work, whether it be a social worker or firefighters or EMTs or psychologists or, you know, whoever across the board who does this kind of work, nurses, they don't realize that witnessing these events and being in these situations are affecting them. And I didn't either, which now looking back, it does seem crazy.
Yeah.
But I just thought somehow I was outside of all of it and that I was, my brain was impermeable, you know, impermeable to, I don't know if that's the right word, but it wasn't going to be affected because it wasn't me who was suffering. Right. I was just the witness. I was the documentarian. And a lot of that trauma from witnessing, you know, these terrible things didn't come up until 5 years later.
Yeah.
Right. So it's such a, like trauma is such a strange thing to me. It's like, I still am, you know, I'm fascinated by it. I'm fascinated by the effect it's had on me, had on people that I know. I study it, regularly to try to understand it more. And I still feel like I'm just scratching the surface.
I don't know. This is my own analogy. I don't know how accurate it is, but in my mind, because you've spent time in the mountains and we can get into that, but, I have this comparison to like altitude sickness. Like if a group is hiking up a mountain, everyone's gonna get altitude sick at some point. Some people happen earlier than others. Some people just the way their body's built, it's gonna happen a little higher up. But no one's gonna call you weak because you're suffering from altitude sickness. It's inevitable because your body has a reaction to altitude. It's going to happen to everyone at different times, different rates. You know, if we looked at trauma and the way it affects somebody, I think we'd have more empathy. I think one of the biggest struggles is it plays out in these interpersonal relationships. The way somebody's acting, they're angry. And so now it's very hard in those moments to go, okay, they're doing this because of, or maybe this is a result of what they've dealt with, because our natural reactions are to defend ourselves you have to be in the right place. It's just like, if I'm not in the right place, I'm more likely to flip off the guy who just cut me off. If I'm in a good place, I could let that go, you know? So it's a tricky, you know, anything with mental health, it's just really tricky. And, you know, I've talked to some people on here that are doing some amazing things. You mentioned the firefighters and police officers, they're dealing with this on a regular basis too. And one of the firemen I talked to, they started using colors instead of words, because words matter. Like things like, hey, how are you feeling mentally today? You know, it's almost like you couldn't tell people at Fort Drum that's what this thing had morphed into, because people would shut down. So they started using colors to say, hey, are you at, you know, green, yellow? And they were more likely, if somebody was getting close to red, to say, hey, like, I'm at orange, I'm not doing well. I think the biggest trick is specifically with the military, and I'll put this on law enforcement too. It's a slow shift, and the response by leadership, even if it's not punitive, it feels punitive. And that goes for pilots. That goes for healthcare workers. I mean, can you imagine being a nurse a doctor in the middle of COVID, be like, I can't do this, I'm too stressed out. Like, that's, people look at that as a weakness, and that's,
Well, that's the other thing, is that when you're doing the job, you're actually functioning best when you're in those situations, right? Because you have a task at hand, and you, like, I became friends with a nurse recently who was at Ground Zero when COVID hit New York, and she volunteered to go there, and basically was seeing people die left and right, seeing the bodies piled up in the, you know, the refrigerators that they had lined up along, you know, the streets in New York City. And, you know, talking to her recently, she's been experiencing a lot of depression and anxiety. And she was like, what's wrong with me? I don't understand why my body is acting this way, yada, yada. Excuse me. And, you know, but when she was working in the ward as a nurse, it was go time. It's like, you're so hyper focused that you don't feel the feelings in the moment, because there's a job to do. Right. And so it's like that leaky roof, like it starts to cave in for me, at least long after those events. And it was when I would come back home, it all came crashing down. And so for me, it was, you know, and I want to talk about, how trauma embodied itself in my life, you know, after the Fort Drum experience, after the sexual assaults, seeing multiple therapists, you know, I started to feel better. But, you know, I continued photographing conflict. I went back to Afghanistan multiple times. I started photographing the war in Iraq, or the conflict in Iraq, that when ISIS invaded, the summer of 2014. So, you know, I was continuing to do this job. And for me, what would happen is I would never get home and go, oh, I don't feel well. It was more like I would function as normal. And then all of a sudden my body would absolutely collapse. Wow. And literally physically, I would have these blackout spells. That's how, you know, physically it manifested in my life. Like, I would never feel like, yeah, it took me a long time to feel it coming on, to realize when it was coming on. And then I started, you know, becoming more mindful of my body and more sensitive, to where I have like a 30-minute window where I can like feel if it's coming. And then I have like time to find a safe place where I can be. But at the time, and, you know, this was in 2016, 17, 18 and 19, for, I would say 4 years, consistently I would have panic attacks that would basically make me not just non-functional physically. I would black out. So I could be walking down the street and I'd fall over. There were several times like in DC, I was walking down the street and I, you know, would basically just have to sit down on the sidewalk or try to find like a safe place where I could just like have the panic attack. And I once, you know, I remember walking down the street and I was in a neighborhood in Pennsylvania and I passed out in a guy's yard and he came out and got me and brought me inside. For me, it was like everything went dark. You know, I wouldn't pass out to the point of being unconscious, but sure, I couldn't see and I couldn't hear and I couldn't make words. And it was my brain's protective, like a possum that plays dead. It was my brain's protective mechanism saying, okay, this is enough and we're going to help you survive. And to do that, we're going to shut off all of your senses, your sense of sight, your sense of hearing. And it was absolutely terrifying because I never knew when it was going to happen. It was like I had zero control over my body. That went on for years.
In itself is, because I've had a loved one kind of deal with something similar, that in itself is anxiety inducing because you have to function. So you know when these things could happen at any moment, that in itself is guessing, is it going to happen today? Well, you know, guess what? That's not great for your mental health. So
exactly, the anxiety that comes with then having the anxiety attacks. You know, and that's the other thing is people didn't know how to deal with me. So like there are a couple times, and this I'm sharing way too much here, but whatever. It's like, you know, I feel like this is important to talk about because I feel like people don't talk about it enough. And that's where the stigma comes from. But there were a couple of times I was almost arrested because people thought I was on drugs. Like I remember I was having one it's always, I don't know why, but it's like a lot of times it's been when I've just been walking down the street in some big city. Where was I? I can't remember if I was in DC or New York, but I found a hotel to go into to just kind of grab onto something. Right. And I didn't want to make a scene, so I tried to go near the women's bathroom. And inside the bathroom, somebody left and went and got the police because I think they thought I was a vagrant or, you know, I looked crazy. So then they would come in. And I remember it was a male police officer came into the women's bathroom and tried to basically move me and that made it so much worse, but nobody ever, you know, it was more like, you know, there wasn't a lot of like, what do you need right now? It was like, you need to leave or whatever. There wasn't a lot of questions. Like, what is this person going through? Like, what is she dealing with? And that was absolutely terrifying. So I was like, oh shit, I'm going to go to jail. Like, I couldn't even see, I couldn't hear, but I could like kind of tell what was going on outside. Like what, my body.
What are you in for? Panic attack. Like
it's like, yeah. Right. And, oh God, it was awful. That was a really hard time and it just went on and I never thought it was going to end. I thought I would never gain, you know, control over my body again. That was scary. Yeah. Right. Because you just think like, I'm going to live with this forever. And it disrupts everything. It would basically put me out for 2 to 3 days because then I'd be exhausted from the adrenaline dump, which happens after a panic attack. And anyway, we'll get to how I overcame that as well, which it's an important story.
Okay. Well, we can start heading that direction now. If you live anywhere near Connor Cook, I would guess that just a physical location might have something to do with it. Cause that dude posts the most amazing pictures of the mountains of Montana that I've like, that guy should be freelanced by the Department of Tourism for the state. Cause he's putting out some pretty amazing stuff, but was geographically moved. As I'm saying this, this sounds ridiculous because you just got back from Ukraine where you're, I've seen the pictures. These, to be able to process what you're seeing, I need to know what your formula is, because it's, there's going to be a lot of people listening to this going, there's got to be some tips here, because you're processing some really heavy stuff and seem to be doing okay. You're not.
Yeah. You know, it took kind of an overhaul, and there was definitely, you know, addicts and alcoholics call it their moment of clarity. And I had that. It was, let's see, it was the winter of 2019. It was a year after my stepbrother had passed away by an accidental overdose. He took cocaine, and it was laced with fentanyl. And that obviously had a huge impact on me, you know, personally and my family, and also helped me look closer at my life. But that whole time that I was having these panic attacks they really started in 2000, I would say 15, and escalated towards 2017 and 18. And then 19 is when, yeah, I started having sort of this, I would say, moments of clarity, but there was like a big one that changed everything. During that whole time, I was self-medicating with alcohol, and I didn't even know that that's what I was doing, because I just thought, oh, I'm just going out for a few drinks with friends, and that's all it was, right? But I was basically subconsciously drinking to numb the anxiety that I was feeling, to kind of sedate myself. And it wasn't on a daily basis. It was more like, oh, I've had a really hard day, I'm going to have a few drinks. And it starts off as that, which is pretty innocent. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something that socially is acceptable. Socially, I don't think anyone would really blink an eye at it, right? You know, but then I would take Valium to help me sleep because I couldn't sleep.
Yeah.
And slowly it starts to snowball.
Yes, it's cunning. They say it's cunning. It starts off with this little thing, and it feels good, and it's good until it's not. But sorry to interrupt.
Right. No, but it's not like it is in the movies where someone, you know, I feel like in films or whatever, and you know, society and pop culture, it's like, oh, I feel like shit, I'm gonna take these pills and then I'm gonna drink to make myself feel better. It's not that at all. It's so subtle. It's so nuanced. I like to, you know, I've gotten into mountaineering in the last 3 years, and I like to compare it to kind of walking on a snowy slope or an ice slope without your crampons on. Like, you could be fine. You could do it. You could do it without slipping, but you could slip. And if that slope's at a, you know, 40 degree angle, you're going all the way down.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was a very dangerous game I was playing that I wasn't even aware that I was playing. Hmm. And that's what's so scary about it, is that if you don't have the practice of mindfulness, you can get into this. You can get on a slippery slope and you think you're fine. And then boom, one day, I mean, that's what happened to my stepbrother, yeah. Right? Who was sober for 7 years. Yeah. And so, yeah, for me, it was drinking, taking the occasional Valium for sleep, which, you know, I didn't think anything was wrong with that. And I guess some people can do that and be fine. But for me, it escalated.
Yeah.
And, you know, two drinks with friends would turn into five drinks, would turn into seven drinks. I'd get home, you know, take some pills to sleep. And basically it got to a point of where I was dangerously on, I don't want to say on the brink of, you know, having some sort of accidental situation happen, because, you know, nothing did happen, thank God. But I was playing Russian roulette.
Sure. Yep.
And it escalated to a point of where my panic attacks were getting worse. You know, I kept blacking out. I almost blacked out on an airplane. It was getting to the point of where I was like, this is not manageable. And somehow the spring of 2020, that light bulb went off. Thank God, you know, I, it was a gift.
What was it? Do you remember the moment where, like, because the further we get away from acting or doing those things, the easier it is to look back and go, oh, that was insane. That was insane. Right.
Yeah.
But it, you know, like some people, they talk about rock bottom and everyone's rock bottom is different. Some people it's just an awakening. Like you said, an awareness. You go, all right, what I'm doing again, if my friend told me they were doing this, I would say, that's not good. Like you need to figure that out. So what was it? Do you remember the moment and what did that feel like to you? And then the second part of that is all right. Well, how did you map out change?
Yeah. I'm trying. I haven't thought about this in a while. I think it was three sort of aha moments strung together in a short period of time. After I almost blacked out on this international flight, by drinking and taking Valium, I got home to Texas and, you know, kind of told my family what had happened. And I think sharing with them my situation and us all have lived through the trauma of Ben dying, like putting those together and that I was putting myself in similar situations was a moment. Shortly after that, like a week later, I went and saw a friend in DC who, you know, you have those friends who don't blow smoke up your ass and will tell you exactly what they think. And she's a friend I've worked with in Iraq, off and on for the past, I don't know, 8 years. She's awesome. Love her. But she went to a bar actually, and I wasn't drinking at this point. And she looked at me and was like, "You're being fucking stupid. Like you're playing with your life." And this is someone who, like, if she says it, then it's true. I mean, yeah, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and she wouldn't have said it if it wasn't true. And she was like, you're being fucking stupid. Like you could end up on YouTube. If somebody filmed you and this happened, like it could end your career. I mean, all these things. Right. And then my therapist kind of reiterated the same thing when I told her. And it was like a switch went off in my brain. And I was like, oh my God, I'm playing this dangerous game. I'm playing with my life. And, you know, luckily I found myself in a situation where this was like January, 2020. I realized, okay, I have to cut way back on my drinking, which I started to do. I cut out any sleep aids that I was taking. I stopped taking any, you know, I wasn't taking any pills, but like, you know, like taking the occasional Valium for sleep or even, what is that drug called that people take for sleep? That's Ambien. Really dangerous.
Ambien.
Yeah. I was taking Ambien. Yeah,
it's a real problem. Yeah.
Oh, Ambien's the work. Like, I can't believe it's a legal drug. It's insane.
It 100% should not. I mean, I don't know if they still are, but they hand those things out like Tic Tacs and like people, the stories of, I mean, it's insane to me that it literally wipes a part of your like
memory.
Yeah. You have no idea what you did 6 hours. Nope. Yeah. You did this. It's like, and you have no recollection.
Nope. And I had it prescribed,
yeah.
Which is also crazy. Right. So like, you know, I hate to say this, but you know, medically speaking, I think that people need to be very careful about what medications they're prescribed.
Yeah.
And second guess. And and really do research, because I didn't know that Ambien created false or synthetic sleep brainwaves. It's not real sleep.
It's not real
sleep. It's like a synthetic sleep mask that, because I would always wake up after taking Ambien feeling exhausted and I couldn't figure out why.
Yeah.
Because it helped me to fall asleep and stay asleep, but then I'd wake up feeling almost worse. And then it's addictive. Ambien is absolutely addictive.
100%.
Anyway, long story short, I stopped taking anything whatsoever for sleep. Except for the occasional melatonin, which is non-addictive. Yeah. I stopped drinking for a time period. And this was January, February, and then COVID hit. And when COVID hit, I moved from Turkey back to the United States, thinking the US would be the safest place to be during COVID.
Yeah. Wrong.
Right? Wrong. Womp womp. And I was living with that same friend, Christine. I was living with her at her farmhouse in Virginia. And, we basically were, hunkered down like the rest of the world, just kind of, staying indoors, not really going out. And I didn't have a vehicle at the time, and I didn't have a way to get around. So I thought, well, I need to buy something. So I bought an old Toyota Sienna 2009.
Minivan. Put a twin mattress in the back of it, didn't you?
I did. Yes. I did. And, I didn't have a lot of work at the time. Nobody was working. Yeah. It was, the beginning of COVID. It was March 2020. So I started driving around in my van, without work. I was making portraits. And I started driving around Virginia and West Virginia and Kentucky. And I, at first I thought, well, what if I just slept in the van a couple nights a week instead of camping, as I was driving around the countryside and threw a mattress in the back. And then I thought, what if I just started to live this way? And at the time I didn't know anything about van life. I didn't know van life was a thing. I just thought I was a weird, out of work, homeless photojournalist living in my van. I was really embarrassed about it. I didn't tell anyone what I was doing because I didn't know it was trendy or cool. And I started living in my van, and that was when I would say my life changed in this way that I never thought was possible. And I say this with a lot of empathy towards people who did suffer from COVID lost loved ones. And, it was obviously a very horrific time for the world and for the US. A lot of people were losing loved ones and people were dying. For me, I was one of the lucky ones who didn't get sick. And I was very careful when I traveled. I would spray my door handles and steering wheel with bleach before driving. Yeah, I was really fastidious because I didn't want to, be blamed as a super spreader or anything, because I was traveling during this time. But I was living in the van, basically, and in the woods. And I did that for off and on for about a year. I'd stay with people or in their driveways in my van.
Yeah.
But I drove from Virginia to New York to Michigan down to Texas. I lived out of my van in California, New Mexico for a while. And it basically was the break that I had needed for the past decade that I didn't allow myself to take until COVID forced me to, because I didn't have work and nobody was really doing anything at the start of COVID. I had the aha light bulb moment of clarity. And then life kind of ushered in this situation that at the time I didn't know it was a gift, but it was. And it allowed me to, slam the brakes on my crazy life of covering conflict and running around to Iraq and Afghanistan all the time to just kind of do this for the first time in a decade.
Yeah.
And it's been everything to me. I mean, that's when everything changed. Mm. that's when I was able to create the space to make these habits to, and you'll see me like tearing up because it was such, even now when I look back on it, you know, I don't feel like I deserved like this gift. Like I feel like there's so many more people who suffer who this could have been given to, but I don't, you know, and I consider myself a spiritual atheist. Like I believe in the woo woo universe, God, yeah, and energy and all that. Sure. But whoever gave this to me, I owe everything to, because, and maybe it was myself, I don't know. Maybe it was my inner, you know, whatever, my bigger self that gave it to me, but it really, my life is completely different now.
Yeah, that's great.
And yeah, it's fucking amazing, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. But and that's, these gifts, man, they're presented to people, and we don't always grab them. Right? Like you just don't take advantage of them. You don't realize. And sometimes they're thrust down your throat. Like it's, hey, you're not working. And to be honest with you, like I'm the same way. I feel like I have to this caveat of saying, hey, COVID was this horrible thing. And I'm sitting here with COVID, right? And I'm having this conversation, but it was also instrumental in me personally starting a podcast that turned into a nonprofit. That's been one of the most rewarding things I could have ever imagined that happened in my life. So, and I always felt weird saying that, right? Because there's so much suffering that's going along with that, but that's my experience. This has been yours.
Well, I feel like a lot of people, sorry to interrupt, but yeah, I feel like a lot of people, COVID presented this opportunity to re-examine and redefine your path. Like what am I doing with my life? Yeah. How am I spending time with my kids? What's my relationship with my job? What's my relationship with my body? Like it was basically this exhale, where I think people had a moment to pause and really look at things clearly for the first time in a long time. Cause I know a lot of people who basically changed careers, moved to a different place, like moved to the forest or a cabin in upstate New York, and their lives are, you know, a lot better for it. So, you know, it was this horribly tragic thing that affected and impacted the world in all these awful ways. But at the same time, I think it presented an opportunity for a lot of people to really stop and kind of have these moments of clarity where they could like reexamine how they're living.
Yeah, I agree. You know, sometimes change is hard. Sometimes you need that little shove off the plank. And for a lot of people, COVID, it was just that. So, so now that you're, how long have you been in Montana now?
Oh, like 4 days.
Oh, are you serious? 4 days.
I literally did. Yeah. I just moved here.
this is another reason I'm grateful. I mean, there's not many people that say, I just moved 4 days ago. I'll take an hour or 2 hours to sit down for an interview. So, thank you for that. Is this Sienna out in the parking lot in the driveway?
It is. Yeah, it is. It's actually right out back outside that window.
Nice.
To talk about the van a little bit, the van was a gift. Everybody thought, you know, when I told them I was living in a van, they're like, oh, like a Mercedes Sprinter. And I was like, nope, it's a soccer mom van. I bought it from a mom with like five kids.
That's you're still finding like Cheerios under the seats.
No, I did. I had to clean out like gum from because this family, I bought it for like $4,000 from this family in Virginia, and there was like gum stuck to the interior.
I heard you telling this story. You're like, well, I got a van and I decked it out I put a bed in it. And, the host was like, oh, did it have like a loft? And you're like, no, it's a Sienna. So I was like, he's like, oh, okay. I thought it was hilarious for someone who I have a Sienna. So,
oh, you do? Yeah, nice. Yeah. I love my van so much. I fucking love my van. It's like my home. It is. I mean, my bed's still in it. I, I still sleep in it. Sometimes when I lived in DC last summer, I would leave my apartment and go sleep in the van sometimes because I missed it so much.
It's hilarious.
But yeah, I mean, so talking about the van, it was a weird, you know, like here I was living in Turkey, had an apartment, had like a group of friends going to Iraq and Afghanistan, to living in my van in West Virginia. What a weird turn of events, right? But that's when I started learning about I knew what mindfulness was, and I kind of understood the concept, but I hadn't really integrated it. And it's such a mindfulness is such a it's an elusive concept. It's so hard to really tap into, and it's so nuanced and almost like, I don't know how to, it's even hard for me to talk about because it's such a bizarre concept. Right. But anyway, okay. So I knew about it. I hadn't really practiced it on a daily basis, but started to, when I was living in the van, because all I was doing was trail running, meditating, like living in the woods and driving around the country and like having, you know, conversations with myself about my life. And cause I was alone 90% of the time, like totally alone. And, over, I would say 6 month period from like March, 2020 through that summer, I started cultivating these habits, and it wasn't even like premeditated. It wasn't like I set out like, okay, I'm going to do these six things. It was almost like they started coming to me. You know, some of them I had to practice and discipline myself to do, but like meditation was one of them. You know, I dabbled in meditation. I always wanted to be a meditator and sort of define myself in that way, but I never made it a daily practice. Yeah. And here's one big thing I've learned over the last 2 years that I think is like critical in terms of habit and life-changing habits and implementing habits, is it's not about the load or the volume. It's about the frequency. Mm-hmm.
Consistency.
It's about consistency. And I heard that, and I was like, yeah, right. Blah, blah, blah. But it truly is, in the sense that meditating, you know, I was the kind of person who would go, I'm going to go to a Zen monastery and I'm going to do Zazen and for an hour at 7 a.m. And I would do it once and then I wouldn't do it again.
Right. Right. So
I'm
going to get up and squat every, you know, like these things you have to, you know, eat that sandwich in little bites. Like you got to build.
Oh
up
my
to,
God. Yeah. Well, and in that case, it is about volume, right? But incremental.
Yeah. Right.
Bite-sized volume bites that you can do on a daily basis. And it builds and builds and builds and builds and builds this massive, amazing thing. Right. So yeah, it was, you know, I went from being this, and I think it's like tapering the extreme mentality. Like I'm a pretty extreme person. I tend to do things 500%. I don't half-ass anything. At least that's been my sort of, history. And I've tapered that a bit in that, like, okay, instead of going out and trying to meditate for 3 hours at 6 a.m., like, can you do it for 10 minutes a day?
Yeah.
Can you be extreme in this whole other way? That's like more bite sized, more baby stepped. And that is sustainable.
Yeah.
And if you can do that, even if it's 5 minutes a day, like there are some days where I was like, I can do 5 minutes, and 5 minutes seems like nothing, but it's the consistency of doing it day after day, even if it's for 1 minute or 30 seconds.
Yep.
And so that was one habit I started to build. And now for me, meditation is like, you know, do I do it every day? No. But do I do it 5 days a week? Yeah. And that's more than I have ever done. So that, you know, that was one habit. And then there's been a string of other habits I've implemented that have been truly life changing. But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, if there's one takeaway from this interview, it's that it's consistency.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I came across, I read Atomic Habits by James Clear, and that's, I would love to say that I implement a lot of this stuff. Cause I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. I've read it more than once and probably practice a very small percentage of it. But one of the main messages is just that, right. Is to say, I think he starts off and says, hey, if you want to run, if you've never run, you're going to run a 10K. I want you to get up tomorrow and just put your shoes on, put your running shoes on. You don't even have to run, put them on, you know, for the first 2 or 3 days. And then the next step, I want you to go outside and go from a telephone pole to telephone pole. But it's almost like brushing your teeth. When you start doing these little things every single day, you don't think about them. They become a natural part of the way you live your life. And when we talk about mental health, it almost becomes your medication, right? Like exercise can become a medication. Time outside becomes a medication. And I personally slip where I realize I'm not in a good place. Oh yeah, I haven't been taking my medication.
Yeah.
And it's not the kind that makes you forget 6 hours of your existence, right? Like an Ambien. Like this is actual, if something makes you feel good instantaneous, my experience has been that it's probably not going to serve you long term. Like, right? There's very few meditations you're going to walk away and be like, oh my God, that was a life-changing experience. But you're going to feel a little bit better. And over time, my friend Jeff Harris says, I always say little hinges swing big doors over time. These things build. And then you've gone, oh man, I'm doing way better than I was. I didn't pass out in a hotel lobby today. So we got that, right? Like these things, like these, you look back and you go, man, from where I came to where I am, there's an ocean. So it's,
oh my God. Yeah. Absolutely. Like, yeah, exactly what you just said. You know, it's, I would say for the past 2 years, I've been consistently more happy, more joyful, more at peace, more relaxed, more content than I have been in the past 20 years.
Ah, what a fantastic thing to say. Yeah.
Again, I see it as a gift. Like I'm so fucking lucky. Mm. I did have to work at it for sure. You know, and like you said, it's not the, and some people do take Ambien and God bless them. Like I have nothing against whatever, if they do fine on it. Right. Yeah, but it's this difference between the quick, easy fix and kind of the harder way that ensures long-term progress. It is harder because it takes more time. You don't see results immediately.
Right.
Like throughout 2020, I still had panic attacks, but they began to taper.
Yeah.
I was able to sense them coming on sooner, and I was able to self-soothe more quickly. And so, you know, basically over time, they went from being this complete body overhaul to where I lost my sense of sight and sound and ability to even stand up. Like, you know, like I said earlier, I would collapse on the floor, to where they began to taper slowly. It took about a year, but in 2020, when I would have them, they'd last, you know, they used to last 3 to 4 hours sometimes.
Wow.
And in 2020, they began to last 10 to 15 minutes. So over time, you know, they went from 4 hours to, you know, 2 hours to 1 hour to 15 minutes. And now I rarely have them, which is insane. It's like I cured myself of a disease by doing really kind of simple things. Sleep. I have a list, and if I'm not doing this list, I'm starting to slip.
Yeah.
And the list is exercise, sleep, hydration. People don't think people don't understand how important water is. It's so important. Meditation, mindfulness, and you know, keeping up with, I would say, therapy rituals, whether that be reading a book about self-help or listening to podcasts, or just, you know, keeping, maintaining that mentality of like, because the moment you think, oh, I'm good, I don't need this anymore, that's You're screwed. Have to do it for the rest of your life.
And that's where that's, I mean, you talk to like people with substance misuse issues, like that, this is a lifelong, I'm in it for life, but my recovery is, requires X, Y, and Z till the day I die. But
it's a lifelong commitment.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why people who haven't had a drink in 20 years still go to AA meetings 7 days a week.
Sure.
Because if they don't, and the moment they think that they're okay and they've got this and they don't need that support, they don't need that reminder, that's when you start playing with fire again. Right.
Yeah.
So it's like, for me, I've now cultivated so much, stability and peace in my life that I'm now very sensitive to when the boat starts to rock. Mm-hmm. So here's a perfect example. This is minor, but it's something that is now kind of, you know, I would say a good example of how, like, where I was and now where I am, where I've come from. 3 days ago, I put my running clothes on and my trail shoes on to go out and do a trail. And I could barely keep my eyes open. This was, I think, when we were texting, and I was like, I'm really tired and, you know, haven't slept well. And before, I would have been like, buck up, go out there, run, like, stop whining. You know, maybe it wouldn't even occur to me that something was off. But now I'm so sensitive. It's like my regulatory system is like, it's so sensitive now that I can tell immediately, not immediately, but I can tell much quicker that something's not right.
Yeah.
And so that day I was like, you know what? I need to sleep. I need to sleep. And I slept for 4 hours during the day, and I woke up, ate something, and went back to bed at 9. And I never would have done that in the past. Now if I don't go to, if I'm not in the woods once a week, I suffer. Mm-hmm. You know, trail running, being in the mountains, being in nature has been a huge therapeutic, medicine, for lack of a better word, in my life.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you look at like in Japan, that, you know, I think they call it like a forest bath, and companies,
companies
have, that's part of their, you know, you have to take your forest bath like every day. Like you're not in the forest, but if they have a little park, they have 20 minutes to go out there, because again, this is science. And we know that if you spend time in nature for 20 minutes a day, that the effects that it has on the body, I mean, it's substantial. It's not a pill. It's not something you need to get to the drugstore. But the effects of it are substantial. So, I think it's important.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I moved to Montana, is to be closer to the woods and to nature. And I actually have a mantra. I have it written down on an index card that I keep in the van. And it says, if you feel lost, go to the woods.
Yeah.
And I always can refind myself, my sense of purpose, my peace, when I go to the forest. It's just it's my happy place. Some people it's the beach, some people it's the mountains, you know, wherever. But like finding that touchstone, to that thing that you can go back to, that sort of rock in the river when you're swimming or flailing for your life, that you can hold on to and be like, oh yeah, this exists for me.
Yeah.
That's what I've found in nature. And I absolutely am obsessed with it now. I have to be surrounded by trees, which, you know, is it's especially nice when I've gone to a place like Ukraine to come back to a place that's safe and the place where I know that that peace for me exists, that I can, you know, cultivate it again.
Yeah. And this is an amazing conversation. I appreciate, one, just being so candid. There's so many things that I would love to cover. I want to be good with your time as well.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm obsessed with this topic. I could talk about it for forever, but, yeah, I just, you know, I think not to sound preachy, but for me, the most life-saving things have been, you know, daily meditation. I only do it for 10 minutes a day. And you know, trail running has been huge, but you know, just the cultivating mindfulness. I use the word cultivate because it's like tending to a garden. You know, you water it, you pamper it, you feed it good food so that the soil can absorb the nutrients. Diet also is a huge thing. The things that we put in our bodies affect our bodies and materialize, and then, you know, really have a much bigger impact than we give it credit for. But yeah, you know, I just, for someone who has, I would say, been through the throes of trauma and has been diagnosed with PTSD, I feel incredibly lucky that I found some solutions that work for me and habits that I've been able to build in my life that have brought me sustainable peace and brought me out of the darkness and back into the light. I'm just, yeah, I'm overwhelmed with gratitude.
And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people listening to this that there's a pattern, there's a theme that's gone across the guests that come on here and they share their story. It's what works for them. But you start seeing the same things popping up, you know, this time in nature, this, when I think mindfulness, again, it's connecting the emotions with the actions and the actions that you do with the emotions that they bring and understanding that why we do the things that we do. And, it's helped so many people. So you sharing your story, I think is really good. It's going to help a lot of people. I honestly think that I think the military people listening on this are going to get a lot from it. So thank you. Thank you for your time and thanks for sharing.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. And I, you know, I love the idea that if people can listen to this and take one tiny thing away, it feels, that's what it's all about, is sharing our stories and trying to help others from what we've learned through our own journey. So thank you so much for having me. This was an amazing chance to get to share that information and talk to you about it.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Erin, you enjoy the rest of your day and look forward to seeing more work and maybe we'll have you back on here sometime soon.
I'd love that. Thanks so much.
Everybody, that's a wrap. Like always, thanks again for checking us out. This show is brought to you by the team here at Consequence of Habit and is an arm of our 501c3 nonprofit. The show is produced and edited by the one and only Anthony Palmer. It's part of the Palm Tree Pod Company network of podcasts. That's it. I'll catch you guys next week.